Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who have always meant to watch classic movies. I'm Nick Hayden.
And I'm your other host, Timothy Deal.
And we're here with episode 28. We are in 1954.
That's correct.
And we are watching
Seven Samurai,
which is a movie that we've meant to watch for Let's Finally Watch This, like, for yes. many times. It's one of those, like, people just mention it, like, we should watch that someday.
We should watch that. We should watch that. Yeah. I did look it up. I'm pretty certain this is the first Kurosawa film I've ever seen, which is feels long overdue.
It is my second.
Second.
After Ikaru, or Living, I guess, is the English title.
English title. Like, probably everyone knows it as Ikaru, I imagine.
Yeah. But yes, welcome. So, Tim.
Yes.
Tell us about the history of movies in 1950s.
Okay, last season, we're going to have two recaps here.
Two recaps?
Sort of, yeah. We're going to talk...
Double your money.
Recap 1950s stuff, and also some... since we're going to Japan today, we talked about Japanese...
We did briefly for the Tale of Princess Kaguya.
That's right. Last season, when talking about 1953, we noted that it was still kind of the end of the post-World War II era, basically. Mm-hmm. Here in 1954, we're 9 years post the end of that war. And we'll talk a little bit more about that from the Japan side of things in a minute.
Sense, yeah.
Yeah. The studio system is pretty much done at this point. In fact, in this year, 1954, is when Loews Theater severed ties with MGM. This is all fallout from the Paramount Decree we talked about before in 1948.
So they no longer own all distribution, production, and...
Exhibition.
Yes.
Yeah. That being said, this is still considered part of the golden age of Hollywood. Historians differ where that ends, usually sometimes in the 1960s.
So I'm going to say, yeah, this is later in the golden age.
Yeah. And to combat the continued threat of TV, we talked about how studios have been turning to color film and spectacle. And last season, in 1953, we talked specifically about 3D, which mm-hmm. I guess 3D had a minor boom of sorts in 1953 and in this year, 1954.
Last year, we talked about our movie was, 2 years ago, was Singing in the Rain?
Yes, 1952 was Singing in the Rain. 1953, we talked about Shane.
Both of which are very big, colorful, epic sort of movies.
Yep.
In different ways.
Yep. And widescreen is also, again, becoming more common. We mentioned that in 1953, only three of the top 10 grossing films of that year were in widescreen. This year, 1954, 6 out of the 10 top grossing films are in widescreen. So that's becoming more of a thing, but not necessarily in Japan yet. One thing with history I want to do a little differently today is I want to talk about all the American stuff first before we get to the Japan
Sounds
stuff.
Sounds good, yes.
So let's look at our top grossing film in America was White Christmas.
Okay, which I've seen recently.
You've seen, yeah. Still a very popular film. The big winner for the Academy Awards this year was On the Waterfront.
Okay, which I've heard of but not seen.
Yes, I have seen this one. It won Best Film, Best Director for Elia Kazan, and Best Actor for Marlon Brando. Best Actress went to Grace Kelly for the film The Country Girl, which was a bit of an upset. It was expected to go to Judy Garland for A Star is Born, which was kind of her big comeback film.
Okay.
And probably a lot of people think she probably should have gotten it. Our other nominations for this episode were actually A Star is Born and On the Waterfront.
Which makes sense, yeah.
Because you've heard of it, and it is still considered a pretty big one in American film history.
Yeah, but Seven Samurai just... There was no contest for us, at least.
There really wasn't. We knew we had to see Seven Samurai because this movie has been talked about and it was influenced so many people. But let's switch things over to Japan here.
So we're post-war Japan.
Yes.
Which went a lot of history. This go to our fellow podcasters.
At the Monster Island Film Vault.
They do lots of Japanese film history.
That's right. We'll
do a rundown here.
Yeah, we'll do a quick recap of some of the things we had to fly through our history of Japanese cinema last time, or when we talked about The Tale of Princess Kaguya. We noted that film technology was first demonstrated in Japan as far back as 1896, first film studio built in 1909, so Japan has a very long film history. In the 1930s is when, of course, the imperialist government basically took over and started having them do propaganda films. Once the American occupation of Japan began, then the Allies mandated and kind of managed certain aspects of the film industry until the occupation ended in 1952, which is really only a few years before this.
2 years before this comes out, at least.
Yes. Now, I will note that the amount that they were censoring was kind of waning by the end of the occupation. one thing that they really, for a while, they were really restricting was the production of period dramas, what are called, I'm not going to even try to pronounce this name that they have here on Wikipedia, but it was very hard to do samurai films because they were really trying to like steer the country away from the nationalism.
For nationalism, yeah.
That kind of fueled the Japan war effort, the imperial government during World War II. That being said, Akira Kurosawa in his film, in his 1950 film, Rashomon.
Okay, I've heard that one.
Yeah, yes. Probably not saying that right, but it is a period drama that involves a samurai, but it's not necessarily glamorizing. It's basically a murder mystery, but it's just set in that period. So again, that's 1950. That's 2 years before the occupation officially ended. So it kind of shows that they were taking, you know, because, and they were never nearly as harsh censors as the imperialist government was. Kurosawa actually said in his autobiography that he had a preference for the American censorship over the Japanese censors. According to, on Wikipedia, he said in his autobiography that the period when the Japanese imperialist censors had their hands on the film industry was, quote, an age that had no respect for creation. And in contrast, the American censors all behaved toward us in a gentlemanly fashion. Not a single one of them treated us as criminals the way the Japanese censors had.
And I don't know exactly what went on, what they censored, but it seems like they want to make movies. They just don't want to fuel certain elements of dissent, I guess, probably.
Yeah, it's
a very, my guess.
It's a very sensitive thing because, you know, us Americans, we're very like, we're all about freedom. And like, how do we promote this and kind of change their way of thinking about this? And so there's a fascinating article about the civil censorship detachments on Wikipedia that you could go check it out if you want more detail. Kind of the way they were trying to kind of funnel Japanese or direct Japanese thinking toward American and stuff, kind of. It is a little propagandistic, but at the same time,
soft propaganda. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of brainwashing the imperialist government had done before this, so it's kind of trying to move it the other direction. So anyway, it's an interesting topic. You can certainly see in this movie, and maybe we'll touch on that in a little bit, some echoes of that. But the other important thing about Rashomon is that film was basically the first Japanese film that really like get major Western attention.
Okay.
It won a major prestigious award at the Vienna Film Festival. It took everybody by surprise because they didn't know, wow, what's going on in Japan?
Yeah. And this is a great thing for Japan. 9 years after war having, or not, no, 5 years.
Yeah.
1950.
Yeah, 1950.
This really outstanding piece of art. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is considered the beginning of Japan's golden age of cinema. The 1950s particularly, because you had Akira Kurosawa, you had Yasuhiro Ozu, who did Tokyo Story, which has sometimes been considered even a better film than Citizen Kane in some critics' polls. Also, there's a director, I was trying to remember the other day, what was a Japanese film from this era that I had seen? It was actually Ugetsu, which is by Kenji Mizoguchi, who is also considered a very prominent Japanese film director this time. And then also, of course, this year, 1954, saw the premiere of Godzilla.
Mm-hmm. Which is also super well known everywhere.
Everywhere, yes. Yeah, so this was a golden age where a lot of Japanese films were being seen by audiences outside of Japan, loved, and because they were just doing really cool stuff in this era. And Akira Kurosawa, the director of this film, Seven Samurai, is a key example of that.
Yeah, Akira Kurosawa seems like he's one of those big names. I think if you know any Japanese director, it tends to be him.
Yeah.
At least classic directors, yeah.
Well, you know, his work has been said to influence a lot of what turned into Hollywood blockbusters, in terms of like pacing and style, and like he's so influential for Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
Those are where I first heard about him. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the film you saw, Akira, was 1952. Yeah.
Okay.
2 years before this one. And this was again a huge decade for him because he also had 1958 was The Hidden Fortress, which is a huge inspiration for Star Wars. 1961 is Yojimbo. His career would last until, I think his last film was 1985, but following the late 60s, his career kind of dipped.
It wasn't as strong as...
It wasn't quite as strong, iconic. Not quite as prolific or as iconic. But right here, we're seeing him at the peak of his career.
I guess before we move on, do you have awards or influences for this particular movie, Seven Samurai?
Well, Seven Samurai has ranked in a lot of different critics' lists of greatest polls. Sight and Sound ranked at number 3 in 1982. It's because they do a poll like every decade, basically. In the 2002, it was ranked 11th. It was 10th in 1992, 9 in 2002.
Still very high up there.
Still very high up there. It's been listed in the top 100 films for Time Out Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, The Village Voice. Roger Ebert added to his list of great movies. It's been listed on all kinds of best of lists. It was nominated for Academy Awards in 1957, probably when it was released in America.
Interesting. Okay.
Way after the fact, for art direction, set direction, costume design. It did win a Silver Lion, not the Gold Lion, which that Rashomon won, but a Silver Lion at the Venice Film Festival. It's been remade into all kinds of things. Now, interestingly, when it was first released in North America, it was released with the title The Magnificent Seven.
Okay.
Which you may also know is the Western cowboy remake that was inspired by it, The Magnificent Seven. And then after they did that, they renamed for subsequent releases. They went back to Seven Samurai.
Which would make sense, yeah.
Probably when the movie first came out, the word samurai was not as widely known, probably in late 1950s. But yes, The Magnificent Seven, which itself has been remade. And Seven Samurai has also had homages in all kinds of things. There's a steampunk anime called Samurai Seven. There was an Italian sword and sandal film. There's some pretty significant similarities between A Bug's Life and this movie we saw.
So, yeah, it's gone from influenced cartoons and other... Yeah,
there's an episode of The Mandalorian that's very similar to this, where Mando and another bounty hunter are protecting the small village.
Yeah, it just has seeped into all sorts of filmmaker thought processes.
Yeah. In fact, one commentator pointed out it may be the first film, or major film anyway, to have the assembling the team trope.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Like, if you think about, like...
Everyone does it now.
Everyone does it. Avengers, The Dirty Dozen, Saving Private Ryan.
Ocean's 18. 11.
Yeah, yeah. It might be one of the first films to do that sort of thing. And Roger Ebert also speculated it might be one of the first to have sort of an opening gambit. It doesn't start off, but basically you're introducing one of your heroes by seeing him do something cool that's not related to the main plot.
Okay.
So it's like,
interesting.
Yeah. And there's a lots of little minutia that we probably won't be able to touch on here since
it's a big movie. It's 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Yes. And that is with a 5 minute intermission, but yes.
Which was nice.
Yeah. I think any movie that's over 3 hours, an intermission should be mandatory. Yeah. That's just my opinion.
All right, Tim, well, give us a synopsis so people have some idea what we're going to talk about if they've not seen it.
Of course. Seven Samurai opens with a bandit gang discussing raiding a mountain village, but they decide that they're going to wait until after their harvest so they have more stuff to steal from the village. The villagers overhear this, that this tragedy is coming, and they go into mourning. They consult their village elder, like, okay, what do we do? How are we is there any way we can survive this? And he's like, we need samurai. And they're very reluctant to do this because they don't have any money really to give them.
They're very poor. They've been robbed before.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. This actually takes place in 1586 in the Sengoku period of Japanese history, which is basically a time when the emperor didn't have much power. There were just a bunch of feudal lords and the samurai who worked for them, meaning this village has probably been picked on many, many times.
And the farmers are at the low end of the totem pole. I mean, socially.
Yes, very much so. So, reluctantly, the villagers go to a nearby city or town. It's not really clear where they go to try to recruit samurai, and they are rebuffed by the ronin who are looking for glory or gold or, you know, it's just something more. They do eventually come across a samurai named Kanbi, who's an aging but experienced ronin, who, in a very startling scene, he shaves his head, including cutting off his top knot, which is just unheard of. Mm-hmm. Not because he's been dishonored, but in order to disguise himself as a monk to rescue a child from a madman. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, this guy is actually a decent person. Maybe he'll have pity on poor little us.
Yes.
And they basically talk him into joining them, but he's like, okay, we're going to need at least seven samurai to do this. And so they have to recruit mostly other misfit samurai.
Yeah, and some aren't even quite samurai.
Yeah, samurai. I mean, and they're like
samurai in air quotes. Yes. And they know it. I mean, there's a trainee. There's a person who claims to be a samurai who may or may not be.
And that one is probably the most important one.
What is
Kanbi.
Kanbi, yeah.
Or Kanbi.
Hello, folks. This is Tim from the future editing. I wanted to jump in real quick and acknowledge that we made an egregious error here. Campy is the name of the leader of the samurai, as I just mentioned. The one that we were trying to talk about here, the guy who may or may not actually be a samurai, is known in the film as Kikuchiyo, played by the great Japanese actor Toshihiro Mifune. But Kikuchiyo, you'll hear us refer to a very temperamental rogue who is very masculine, very rambunctious. His name is Kikuchiyo. We'll continue to say in the original recording the wrong name, so my apologies about that. Wanted to go ahead and acknowledge that now rather than wait till the end of the season to correct it.
Sorry, we don't speak Japanese fluently. Probably butchering all these names.
And they get a samurai who is like absurdly...
the stoic faced, really good at what he does, kind of. I'm very curious. My main familiarity with samurai stories before this was anime. I mean, primarily Rurouni Kenshin and Samurai Champloo. Well, that one's kind of roughly samurai anyway, or samurai inspired, probably more like. But I'm curious because, like, I recognize archetypes in this movie, and I'm curious whether this movie defined those archetypes or whether they existed in Japanese folklore before this.
Yeah.
Anyway, they've assembled this team. They go to the village and basically have to teach these villagers who are kind of afraid of them.
Fearful villagers, yeah. Because, afraid of them, afraid. They're afraid of everything.
Yeah, because honestly, a lot of the bandits who are terrorizing them were probably former samurai themselves.
It sounds like samurai sometimes just loot and pillage villages for their lords anyways. Like, they're not always good.
Yeah, and sometimes if a lord lost power and the samurai was basically out of a job, he just became a bandit anyway, because apparently I read somewhere it was it's a samurai code to do menial work.
Okay.
You had to live as a warrior, so
you find a way to do war.
Yeah, basically. And that becomes a big sticking point of the villagers not completely trusting the samurai, a samurai beginning to wonder if they can trust the villagers. But somehow they organize a defense of this town, and basically the last...
And we have a very good sense of how this town is defended. Like, they do a very good job of giving us the lay of the land and the plan. It's easy to follow.
It is.
It kind of makes it more effective.
Very true. A lot of their planning stuff is the first half of the movie, and then after the intermission, in the second half is basically the battles.
And it's like a couple days of battles, at least.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first place where I see, like, they actually check off every bandit they kill, but they know there's like 40 of them, and they just, okay, we're down to 30.
It's very satisfying that way.
Yeah.
But I think that's all the setup that we can do. We've had to talk about a lot of stuff because we only have 12 minutes to talk about this 3.5 hour movie.
Yes, it's going to be rough.
It is going to be rough. All right, you ready to give this a shot,
Nick? Let's do this thing.
Okay, 12 minutes begins now.
One thing that I think I know is going home, I think I mentioned right after the movie, is that, so it's the seven samurai defending this village, but it seems like a microcosm for, like, everything.
Sure.
And I think just the way it gets filmed is, like, it'll bring up these important things about life and present it, and then just kind of leave it there. Like, it's not being like, you decide, but it's sort of like, and this is the world about this. I made a list the next day just of, like, kind of things that microcosms, things that it encapsulates. And I was stretching a little bit for some of them, but I think most of these are true. I mean, obviously it's war. I mean, it's these 40 bands against this village, but it's war.
It feels more like a war film than like a shoot 'em out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then just suffering, like how life is suffering. Because a lot of the villagers is like, there's just...
That's all they're doing.
There's one old lady
who's
like, just, I'd rather just die because life has been so hard. Justice, speaking of old ladies, these bandits have abused the city. And so when they capture one alive, like, do we interrogate him? Do we kill him? This old lady wants to just kill him. And they just, it's just there.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily say whether it's right or wrong. It just says, here's your options. And then the old lady.
It's like, I'm going to do it. Yeah. It's interesting because the samurai at first are trying to, like, protect him, like, because all the villagers would just want to string him up. Mm-hmm. But they're like, hang on. And the samurai's, no. The old lady comes like, nope, he's going to die. And they're like, well, okay.
Class struggle, but there's really this tension between the samurai and the farmers. That comes out in various different ways.
Oh, and that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
Think, you know, again, this coming so soon after World War II, and again, they hadn't been able to do samurai film for a while, and here you have one where the samurai are not necessarily...
Some of them are great, and some of them aren't.
Yeah. Akira Kurosawa himself was a descendant from a samurai family.
Okay, interesting.
So he's really dealing with the subject matter honestly, like wrestling with it. And I imagine as much as after having basically not really being allowed to like do history films for a few years, they're probably happy to get back to it. But at the same time, I imagine following World War II, there's also probably a lot of soul searching going on of like, okay, what do we do with this? We know that our own history is pretty checkered.
And I think that's one fascinating thing about this movie, just it has a lot of realism to it. And it just sort of, it doesn't give easy answers. Like the samurai are good, but not always, you know?
Yeah.
And the farmers aren't like, they're not like the noble poor either.
Yeah.
Like they have issues going on too.
Yeah.
About lying and other such things.
Yeah. One of the most fascinating scenes is when it's uncovered that the farmers have a bunch of samurai armor that when the samurai see this, they're very serious. And at first you're like, what's going on? And they're like, look, there's no way they would have this unless they've killed some of our fellow samurai. And then Kambi?
Who's the most fascinating character?
Yeah.
How do we define Kambi for everyone?
Pure masculine energy in a lot of ways.
And he'll like crow and make crazy jokes, but he also has like this deep internal hurt.
Yes. It's interesting because the samurai themselves, like the stoic guy who's really good at stuff, is kind of a classic Japanese warrior archetype. But some of them are actually, again, probably because they're less concerned about their own reputations than the other ones that wouldn't pay attention to them. They actually do a lot more smiling than I would have expected.
Some of them are very jovial.
They're very jovial, you know, laugh and all this stuff. But Kanbei is in a class all of his own.
He's nuts.
And when this samurai armor shows up thing, he basically is like, look, yeah, farmers are lying, manipulative, ugly creatures because you samurai made them, turn them into this. You've raided them. You've raped their women. You've done all this terrible stuff. What else are they going to do but like backstab you if they have a chance?
Yeah. That's a powerful scene too.
Yeah. It's less like, what do we do with this?
Yeah. Another
going back to your list.
I'm just going to my list, guys. This is just how big of a, I think this movie just in some ways a very simple directed movie, but just it touches on a million things.
Mm-hmm.
Abuse of women.
Oh, sure.
I mean, this is all over. I mean, one of the guys has a wife who's, I thought she was dead the way he was acting.
Mm-hmm.
We find out later that the bandits have her and has basically just been using her.
Yeah.
And it's just a horrible scene.
Yeah.
Again, everything's implied. Like, you don't see much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Even as violent, even killing the 40 bandits, you don't actually see, there's not blood or anything.
No, not really. You know, the character Kambi, we were fascinated by. I know Janelle could get annoyed by him sometimes because, like, on the one hand, he had that whole speech about, like, you know, you're raping their women, all this stuff. But then he'll go around and hit on one of the village women in a way that she doesn't really look like she appreciates.
No, I mean, some of the samurai are relatively...
honorable?
No, I'm going to say some are not. I mean, these women, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Even the good guys are a little bit like that sometimes. Mm-hmm. But then we have this whole love story, too.
That's
which
true.
Which has this very interesting triangle thing going on about honor and shame and young love and war.
Yeah, that's a whole subplot I didn't really get to.
No, and that gets complicated. And that's, there's this climactic scene with this love story. And you almost have this shot where there's three people standing there, all with like different points of view. And they just kind of... let the shot sit there.
And hard to say that's even really resolved. I mean...
I don't think it's resolved.
Yeah.
I think it just kind of is.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, we wouldn't like that, but I mean...
It works in that because of the messiness of war in some ways.
Yeah, there's an honesty to it. It's not like just a sense of like, well, let's do these things because they're dramatic. It's like, no, this is real life.
This is real life, and this is a struggle. And I think the struggle real life comes out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go through all these. It's cycles of violence.
I will say, since we're talking about this movie being realistic, the battle tactics are all interesting, but this is definitely, certainly not a movie that you're going to go to for tightly choreographed battle scenes.
No, that's true. It's more like real life battle. I mean, it's just kind of a little chaotic.
Probably. I mean, like, you got horses running around, and you got, kind of just looks like swords and bamboo spears are being kind of waved willy-nilly until someone falls off a horse, and then all the villagers descend on him like angry ants.
Yeah, that's true.
To stab him to death. You understand the pacing of the battle is really well, but yeah, just don't necessarily looking for, you're not going here for stylized action sequences.
No, not at all. I could ramble on, but I don't know. I don't want to use all the time just doing these themes necessarily.
I'll do some more for me.
Yeah. Okay, mob mentality. You know, because the villagers really are this.
Oh, mob. Yeah.
You know, they're in and they're out and they're like, well, I'll work and they won't and they yell. I mean, there's this like the samurai have to like pump them up sometimes, get them calm down. It's really a lot of that sort of stuff going on. It's just it's interesting. They're not, and this is courage fear thing. Who's Yoe? Is that his name?
Oh yeah.
The guy. Okay, his face is stuck in this perpetual like deep. Cartoonish frown.
Yeah. Apparently he had a reputation for playing downtrodden characters.
And he was, but it's interesting because he's the most fearful, he kind of represents the fearful villager.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of has this scene where he's, I did what you wanted me to, except then he dies. And there's kind of this arbitrariness to some of the deaths sometimes. Like,
yeah.
There's some people that die, especially the samurai, just like, there's no reason necessarily just because it's war.
It's war. It just happens. That's true.
And a lot of change, you know, they're trying to move people from houses they've always lived in. There's just a lot of very interesting.
Yeah.
And again, that's a whole run through. There's a girl who has to dress up like a boy to avoid the samurai. I mean, there's
a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff, but it's not chaotic. It flows from one thing to another, episode by episode.
And I do think that's one of the impressive things about this is that anytime you're watching a foreign film, there's going to be culture that's going to be new to you. And there might be some things like, okay, I don't quite understand this moment, but the general thrust, the overall direction of it is very easy to follow.
It is.
I don't know if this is a factor, but I do know Akira Kurosawa grew up watching Western film.
Okay.
He had an innate understanding. So it influenced him a little bit, but at the same time, he still is putting his own Japanese imprint on his filmmaking. So, but I don't know if that helps in some ways. And kind of, I saw someone compare this to High Noon a little bit, in that you've got the same sort of sense of, you know, a bandit's coming to town, and you've got a deadline to prepare for it. And it's like, oh, maybe. I checked the timeline. High Noon came out in 1952. And it is possible he started writing this a few months after that.
Okay.
It may have been an influence. But he certainly knew Westerns. And that is, again, one of those reasons why samurai and cowboys have this some similar DNA. Mm-hmm. You know, we can compare this to Shane a little bit. Another story of a outsider who has to come in and protect the town.
It had some of that vibe, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a story that's in the zeitgeist, not necessarily that Shane inspired this, I don't think. But it's an interesting recurring theme that we tell in our stories.
And it's interesting to pull the Japanese-ness out of it. There's a lot of space where it just kind of sits there. Like, it's just like that moment. We said there's a name for it that we couldn't remember. That's where it will just pause.
Yeah.
For a second. Like, you just look at all the faces and they'll just, no one says anything. Mm-hmm. It's a lot slower than we would be used to nowadays.
Yeah. I felt the first half sometimes moved a little too slow.
Yeah.
That may just be me. But
the first half's very, very set up.
Yes.
And it all pays off well, but it is a little slower than the second half.
And it's one of those cases where it being the origin of a lot of tropes, you kind of recognize a lot of,
like, get moving.
Yeah, let's get going. We know these story beats already, but this is one of the first ones that did that.
Mm-hmm.
So at least in this way. So yeah, personally, I thought the beginning was a little on the slow side, but apparently when they first marketed this, I think in America, I think they cut out about 50 minutes worth.
Okay.
And I can imagine like some...
There's places you can do that.
Probably that whole little side tangent about them losing the food and then the guy paying for it and things that didn't have a huge impact down the road. But other than that, so That's time. We talk about a whirlwind topic.
Yes, I know.
So give me your kind of overall concluding thoughts about this one, Nick. What did you think about this?
First off, I can completely see why it's influenced so many people. It is like I said, the first half's a little slow. Second half's great.
Yeah, it keeps moving.
I think it's absolutely a classic movie worth watching. I mean, it's an epic, so it takes some commitment.
Yes, for sure.
I enjoyed it, yes. So I'll just leave it there.
I enjoyed it, too. When I was thinking about it the week after, I was like, okay, there's no question that intellectually I appreciated this. I was like, but do I love this? It's one of those, like, yes, it's undeniably a great film. I didn't come away with an immediate impression. It's like, oh, man, this is so fantastic.
I would agree. Like, I didn't have that deep emotional, like, yes, I must show everyone this.
Yeah.
This is one of those, like, you like movies? You should watch this.
Yeah. It feels very foundational. Like, I can totally understand why people say it's foundational and how it would be foundational for the filmmakers who were brought up on
and
this.
It does a lot of things really, really well.
Yeah.
Question for you. I know we don't have questions, but...
Go for it.
The other giant epic we watched was Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Compare and contrast?
I mean, that's a very different kind of story and a very different kind of scale. Interestingly, this movie, I know, was a very expensive film for Japanese movies in the day, but it was pretty modest compared to Hollywood standards.
I mean, basically,
budgets.
Like, two sets. I mean, two main locations. I mean, lots of sets, but...
But, I mean, they made that whole village,
Did apparently. They make the whole village?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a lot of the battle sequences were filmed using multiple cameras because it's one of those things, they couldn't replicate stuff, so you had to have two camera shots.
So much rain and mud that last battle.
Yeah, that's true. So I think it's really hard to compare. I think they're very different experiences. But
anyways,
good question.
So we would say, great movie, probably essential if you want to build your classical moviness.
Yeah.
But
and I would
we
say
didn't have a deep emotional attachment to it.
Yeah. If you're big into anime, I would highly recommend it for you, especially in the Japanese culture. Like, this is such a touchstone for Japanese film, right in the heart of the golden age of Japanese cinema. If you're not into that, or if you're not into certain some of this stuff, like, I don't know if I want to sit through all that. It may not be for everyone, but there's some people that it's definitely well worth watching.
And I am glad to have watched it. I have no regrets that way.
I agree.
Well, Tim, after that, probably longer than we should have, short version.
It's Seven Samurai.
It's Seven Samurai. We could have done 2 hours on it.
Probably. And I'm sure we didn't really say anything new, but this is to introduce people to the idea.
Yes. Next time, we're 1964, and we are watching...
A Fistful of Dollars.
Togaru from Samurai to Cowboys. So,
that's right.
It worked.
And a spaghetti western starring Clint Eastwood in his classic role. Basically the role I think he was commenting on with Unforgiven.
Yeah.
So we're kind of going backwards in this particular case. But I think it'll be very interesting to compare it to this movie. And also interesting to compare it to Shane.
Yes.
Which was our 1950.
10 years earlier.
10 years. 11
years.
Yeah. Should be good stuff.
All right. Until next time, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.